Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate the time you're willing to take to drive here and listen to an over two-hour Bible study. Derek, thank you so much for being willing to do this. He has enough courage to defend what he believes, and I appreciate that. We don't agree, but we're becoming better friends as we do this Bible study. As I said last night, it's not a contest. You don't go to a Bible study and try to win it. You just have a Bible study trying to learn what the truth is. Now, Derek started out his first speech kind of the way he started out last night. He said, and he's talking about the Old Testament. Old Testament instruction is still binding unless specifically repealed. So I asked him last night about the Levirate marriage law. Remember Deuteronomy 25, verse 5 and following? The Sadducees asked Jesus about it in Matthew 22. My brother Hunter marries, and he dies before he has any children. Then my brother, number two brother, Ben's about to marry his widow. If he dies, I'm going to have to marry. I'm number three brother. Marry the widow. If I die, my little brother Chris is going to have to marry that. According to the Levirate marriage law, it's not specifically repealed in the New Testament. Then why is it not still binding, Derek? We can't just pick and choose which of these things are still binding. It's either all or nothing. And that's what I want to point out. All of the old law has passed. Notice Galatians 3, 24 and 25. Wherefore the law was our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after that faith has come, we're no longer under a schoolmaster. 25 says we're no longer under the schoolmaster. 24 says the law is our schoolmaster. We're no longer under the law. Not just no longer under part of the law. Like just the law that we like or just the law that hasn't been repealed. And Carol, thank you for getting these verses on my computer today. We're no longer under the law. That's all the law. And that's the very point of Hebrews 7:12. For the priesthood being changed, there's made a necessity to change also of the law. What's the argument there by the writer? The priesthood must have changed, or Jesus couldn't be our priest today, because he's not from Levi. He's from Judah, the tribe of Judah. He says, well, the priesthood must have changed because Jesus is our priest, our high priest. And if the priesthood changed, the law must have changed. Here's the argument. If one part of the law changed, the whole thing must have changed. That's the argument of the writer of Hebrews here. So the whole thing has changed. We could show about two more dozen passages showing the law has changed, including verses from the book of Genesis, Derek. But what we're going to do now is we're going to say we can show many passages saying we're no longer under the law, but let's look at it from the other perspective. What law are we under? Does it include parts of the old law, the parts that have not been specifically repealed? No. We're under the New Testament law. Here's Hebrews 9:15. Talking about Jesus, it says, and for this cause he is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. Now, let's think about this. We've got a New Testament here. I think we know that's Matthew through Revelation. Then he talks about the first testament. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's Genesis through Malachi. He says, Jesus is the mediator of the New Testament, not the first testament. This shows us exactly what's binding today. The New Testament is what is our law for today. Not any part of the Old Testament. That's the first testament. The thing in this passage is that Jesus is not the mediator of. And if he's not the mediator of it, then that's not our law for today. So what I'm saying is we're under the New Testament exclusively. Not New Testament plus patriarchal law, as I think Derek's saying. Not, of course, last night we pointed out he's not consistent in that. Because in Genesis 4:4 they have animal sacrifices. That's part of the patriarchal law. And circumcision was part of the patriarchal law, but he doesn't believe those things are still binding today, so he's not consistent on that. Not New Testament plus patriarchal law, not New Testament, even New Testament plus Psalms and Proverbs. It's none of the Old Testament is binding, as we would say in Alabama, nothing, honey. I agree that all the Old Testament is for our learning, and this is addressed as a point that Derek made last night, but doesn't Romans 15:4 say the Old Testament is for our learning? Certainly does. Let me illustrate. How can the Old Testament be for our learning and not be binding today? His argument is, well, if it's for our learning, wouldn't that mean it's binding? No. Illustration. We learn from the Old Testament animal sacrifices. Don't we learn from that? Yeah, we learn that without shedding of blood, there's no remission, among other things. So we learn from the Old Testament animal sacrifices, but that doesn't mean they're still binding. We don't have to do animal sacrifices today. You see that? So how much of the Old Testament do we learn from? Every verse in there. Every word of it we learn from it. Not just the ones that aren't specifically repealed or are specifically repealed. We even learn from the ones there that are specifically repealed, like circumcision. We learn from circumcision. We learn from animal sacrifices. Those have been specifically repealed, but Romans 15:4 is still saying we learn from those. We learn from the animal sacrifices. They've been repealed. So how much of the Old Testament do we learn from? Every word of it. How much of the Old Testament is still binding today? Not a word of it. We don't have to obey it anymore because it's not binding anymore. We obey the New Testament. He talked about, I'm getting ahead of myself, but he talked about Noah. He talked about Noah and the rainbow. Look, God said he'll never destroy the world with water again, right? That's not an instruction that we're supposed to obey. That's a fact. Facts don't change. It's the instructions that can change. For example, John 1:1 says that God made the heavens and the earth. That's just a fact. That's never going to change. It doesn't matter how many laws you change, how many circumcisions you change, how many Old Testament laws you change, it's still going to be true that God made the heavens and the earth. We're not saying the facts changes. We're talking about the instructions of how we're supposed to live our life. The law. So he's talking about facts and he's confusing facts with instructions. Facts don't change. Facts don't change. It's the instructions like remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. That changes because the Sabbath is no longer binding according to Colossians 2, 14 through 17. Now, last point at the bottom of this. Last point at the bottom. This is a moot point anyway, Derek, because the reason Derek brought up this argument that the laws in the Old Testament that haven't been specifically been repealed, the reason he brought that up last night, at least he did last night, was to say that Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, which relates to Moses' law on divorce and remarriage, he was saying then that that still applied today because it hadn't been specifically repealed. That's why he brought this whole argument up. But after I proved from Matthew 19, 8 and 9 and Mark 5, 31 and 32 that Deuteronomy 24 was specifically repealed, Derek admitted last night Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 has been repealed. So there's really no reason for this argument. Even if I were to agree that the only things that are done away are the things that are specifically repealed, it would not make any difference in this debate because Derek agrees that Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 does not apply today. And then, love you, Derek, okay? And then Derek's next point was that apoluo does not mean divorce. What's apoluo? It's the Greek word translated in the Old King James Version, put away. In all the newer translations, it's translated divorce. We'll show that in a minute. He's saying apoluo, where you read whoever puts away their wife, except to be for fornication, he said that's apoluo, puts away. He said it doesn't mean divorce. It just means to send away without divorcing them. Just to send them away, and you don't divorce them. Let's look at the actual scholars, the ones who studied the Greek, the ones who wrote the Bible dictionaries. They're defining the Greek word, not the English word here. Artin Giegler say it means, this word apoluo, to dissolve a marriage relationship to divorce. Thayer, the most popular Greek lexicon, as far as I can tell, more people use it to him than anybody else, use of divorce. Strong's, many of you have Strong's Concordance at the back of the dictionary, says it means to divorce. Vine, a lot of people use W. Vine's Bible dictionaries, defining the Greek words, used of divorce. He gives some examples, like Matthew 19, verse 9. Barry's lexicon, to put away a wife, divorce. You see, he thinks of put away and divorce as synonymous. He says it means to put away a wife, divorce. Those mean the same thing in his eyes, in the English, and that's what the Greek means, according to him. The analytical Greek lexicon defines apoluo to divorce. Green's Greek concordance means, it says it means to divorce. This next one, Lyle Scott, says it means to divorce a wife. I'm just saying this to make my point. I love Derek. I think he's a great guy. But let me say this. It's sort of to be said tongue-in-cheek. I guess all of these many Greek scholars and lexicons, Derek, are just wrong, and you're the only one that's right on this. You know more how to define the Greek word than these guys who've been studying it all their life. Now, that's looking at the dictionaries, how they define the word apoluo. They're practically unanimous. As far as I know, they are unanimous, but I'm not going to say they are because there may be one that didn't say that. They're unanimous as far as I can tell. It means divorce. Let's look at the translations. You see, Thayer is a man, and man can make mistakes. Of course, Derek, man can make mistakes. He's the man that's telling the definition of the Greek word, apoluo. But we have translators, like the 1611. What, was there something like 100 different translators that worked on the King James Version? Same thing in these other translations that he brought up, American Standard, NIV, New King James, in New American Standard, RSV. There's many, many translators that worked on these translations. Let's look at what the translations say when they translate this word apoluo. First of all, we have the King James Version. And I happen to use the old King James Version. Matthew 5:32. Whosoever shall apoluo, translated put away, his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whoso marrieth her that is divorced, committeth adultery. Now notice, there's apoluo at the end, and the King James translates it, divorce. One time the verse put away, the second time in the verse apoluo is translated divorce. Now we use it interchangeably. He's saying, here's a man that puts away his wife. He's doing wrong. We'll talk more about that later. He's doing wrong. That's apoluo. Then he says, and if somebody marries that woman who's been apoluo, put away, or he translates it divorce. The woman got apoluoed, translated put away, and then it talks about the woman that got apoluoed. Put away, he translates it divorce. You see, put away means divorce. And in this verse, they're used synonymously, interchangeably. They're getting that right. Aren't they used interchangeably and synonymous in the King James Version of Matthew 5:32? They are. The woman got apoluoed, the man apoluoed her, put her away, divorced her, and then it says at the end of the verse, the man that marries that woman who just got divorced in the first part of the passage, apoluo, commits adultery. Now, let's go to the newer translations, okay? New King James, New American Standard, Revised Standard, NIV, ESV, they all have these ways of translating these verses with apoluo, consistently this way. Matthew 5:32 says, whosoever divorces, that's apoluo. At the end of it, whoever marries that woman that's been apoluo, divorce. You see how they're all translating apaluo, divorce? Evidently, these experts, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them on these different translations, they all think apaluo means divorce, or they're synonymous. How about Matthew 19:3? The Pharisees, is it lawful for man to apaluo, divorce his wife? Matthew 19:9, whoever apaluo, divorces his wife, and whoever marries her that is apaluo, divorced. Mark 10:11, whoever divorces, that's apaluo. And if a woman divorces her husband, that's apaluo. It's the Greek word apaluo. What does it look like apaluo means, audience? What does it look like it means? Luke 16:18, whoever apaluos his wife, translated divorce. And if you marry that woman that's been apaluoed, divorced, you commit adultery. If you look at the experts, the Greek experts, the ones that know, the ones writing the dictionaries, telling us what the words mean, and the translators who are doing the same thing, that's not like writing a dictionary. Translator's different, but you're still required to tell what the words mean. They all say it means divorce. Why would Derek say this? We'll talk about that more in a minute. But he wants there to be a way that a man can put away his wife for a reason other than fornication, marry another, and not commit adultery, even though Jesus said that he does. That's why he says, we'll talk about that more in a minute. So he says, really what these verses are talking about is putting away without the benefit of divorce. That's what he says. But let's see how that would work in Matthew 19:9. Hey, first part. That says, whosoever shall put away his wife, that's apaluo. Whosoever shall apaluo his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, commit adultery. Okay, we've already read that. Now let's think about that. Don't we all agree that implies that a man could put away his wife if he did it for fornication and remarry without committing adultery? Isn't that what it implies? It teaches if you put away your wife not for fornication and you remarry, you commit adultery. But it also implies if you put her away for fornication and you remarry, you do not commit adultery. Everybody agreed on that. Now let's put in Derek's definition for apaluo here. That would mean a man could send away his wife. This is his definition for apaluo, send away without divorce. If his wife commits fornication, he could send her away without divorce, and he could remarry without committing adultery. If that were true, that means we have bigamy there. Here's a woman commits adultery. The man could send her away without divorcing her and remarry, and it would not be adultery. He'd be married to two women at the same time because he never divorced that woman. If apaluo here doesn't mean divorce, it only means send her away. He apaluoed her for fornication. God says you can remarry if you do that without committing adultery. So according to Derek's position, that means bigamy is authorized by this verse. I think we all know what marry means in Matthew 19:9, don't we? When he says, Jesus says, if you put away your wife and marry another, everybody know what marry means. I think, isn't it obvious when he says put away or divorce in the newer translations, he's talking about whatever the opposite of marry is? If I marry Carol, which I did in 1988, what does divorce mean? It means I undo that. It's the opposite of marry, right? We know what married means. Married doesn't just mean shacking up, does it? You come together, two people are officially put together. They're not just sleeping together. They're put together officially. That's what married means, right? Divorce is going to be the opposite of that. It's not just sending somebody away or leaving somebody. It's becoming unmarried from them officially because divorce is the opposite of married. We know what married means. We can tell what put away means in the Old Testament by comparing Jeremiah 31, 3, verse 1 to Deuteronomy 24, 1. Here's Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 5. I'm not going to read the whole 1 and 5. Actually, it should have said 4 then. 1 and 4. When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give her in his hand, give it in her hand, send her out of his house. Then verse 4 says, her former husband, after she remarries, her former husband, and she leaves the second marriage. I'm skipping some stuff here. Her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. Okay? Now, Jeremiah 3, verse 1 is talking about that. I think Derek will agree with that. I think we're all going to agree. It's referring back to Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. It says, they say if a man put away his wife, and she go from him and become another man's, shall he return unto her again? He's referring back to Deuteronomy 24, 1. There's been a divorce, and a sending away, and a bill of divorcement. She gets another husband. Can she go back to the first husband? That's the question of Deuteronomy 24, 4, and that's what Jeremiah 3 is referring to. He's referring back to Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. Now notice Jeremiah 3, 1 just says, if a man put away his wife, which if you compare the two verses, that's equivalent to in Deuteronomy 24, 1, let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. So put away is not just equivalent to the send away without divorce. Put away in Jeremiah 3, 1, Derek, includes the sending away and the bill of divorcement, both. Put away includes both write her a bill of divorcement and send her out of the house when you compare those two passages. Derek said there was translations like the Latin Vulgate and Wycliffe did not translate to divorce. And it wasn't until whatever century he said they didn't start translating to divorce. And I don't have any way right now to check that argument, Derek, right? There's no way for me to check that in the 1 minute I have while you were speaking that. But let me say this. The Latin Vulgate and Wycliffe are translations that were made hundreds and hundreds of years after the New Testament was written. We have manuscripts, and there's so many manuscripts, we know what the originals look like, even though we don't have the originals. That's how we know we have accurate translation. We have copies of the originals, many, many manuscripts. The guys translating the Bible, and the guys writing the dictionaries, but the translators for the most part, they're not going back to 300 or 500 or 700 AD. They're going back to the manuscripts, which are copies of the originals. See, so the translations that we have that translated divorce there, go way back before what Wycliffe and the Latin Vulgate, way back before that. They're going back to the copies of the original manuscripts to figure out how to translate it. Not to some translation done many centuries later. But if it's the age, then we're trumping that easily. Eric said, if Pat's position is true, somebody's going to have to remain celibate. But I guess you could say that's unfortunate. But that's it. I've debated the gay church people 8 or 10 times, and that's exactly the argument they make with me. Pat, if you say, I've debated gay marriage, if you say we can't marry or have sex together, gays, then you're saying we've got to remain celibate. So according to their reason, we ought to allow them to have sex together, allow them to have gay marriages, because otherwise they're going to have to remain celibate, no gay sex. Exact argument Derek's making, but Derek would agree the argument doesn't prove what they're saying. It's a false argument. Here's Matthew 19, verse 12. There be some which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of God's sake. They have to remain celibate in that case, if they do that, right? Suppose a man becomes paralyzed or impotent. Suppose I become paralyzed or impotent. Wouldn't that mean Carol's going to have to remain celibate for the rest of my life? Does that authorize Carol going out and getting with another man? Because she can remain celibate, but Derek would agree with me. If I become paralyzed, my wife's going to have to remain celibate the rest of my life. So obviously he doesn't really believe his own argument here. The fact that somebody's going to remain celibate means we can ignore what Jesus says.
That's time. You can finish your point if you want to.
Really. Okay. Sorry, I didn't watch the clock. One more that's supposed to be funny. It makes the same point. Suppose a homely man can never get any woman to accept his marriage proposal. He's going to have to remain celibate his whole life, isn't he? Does that prove he can go out because he's going to have to remain celibate, he can use the services of a prostitute? Of course not. So just because somebody's going to remain celibate doesn't mean we're authorized to disobey what Jesus says and contract a second marriage after divorce, one that Jesus calls adultery. Thank you very much for your time.